Sir Eli, in the first interview, we covered your early life and your memories of your parents. This takes us up to the early years of the war, and we come now to your time in the United States from 1940 to 1944. Your father went there on a Carnegie Fellowship and took your mother and yourself with him. Do you recall the journey by sea?
Well, let me just go back a few months in that narrative and recall that, in fact, my father was invited by the Carnegie Foundation to go to the United States to give a number of lectures at a series of universities, mainly in the East and Middle West of the United States. And this he did not wish to do without the approval, indeed encouragement, of the British Foreign Office. They were very keen that he should do it because they wanted some antidote to the isolationism that was prevailing in quite a number of universities in the United States. So they encouraged him to go. And at the same time, arrangements were made with the help of a committee at Yale for the reception of children of academics from England who were evacuated to the United States. So I went with my father and my mother came with us. And this was in October 1940. And we left Cambridge in October 1940 took a train to Liverpool. And there we got on board the ship called the Scythia, and we set sail for the United States, not in very encouraging circumstances, because the sister ship of the Scythia had been torpedoed the night before, and we weren't told about it, so that we couldn't get off even if we had wanted to. So we had an interesting journey across the ocean. My father, most unusually for him, kept a kind of diary. Not really a proper narrative of the voyage, but just a few jottings of things that struck him as memorable or amusing. And I have the text of that, and will in due course be including it in the biography of my father that I am meant to be writing at the present time, but seem never to get round to. But it's all there. But we arrived in the United States after, I think, a 10-day voyage. And we were met in New York by a friend of my father's, Professor Phillips Bradley, who had been at the London School of Economics and knew my father from there. And we were given hospitality in Bradley's house. And I was immediately placed in a school in New York called Horace Mann, a very well-known and high-quality private school in the northern part of the Bronx. And there, initially, I was a boarder until eventually my mother found a flat not too far from the school so I could walk to the school each day. In the meantime, my father, within days of our arrival in the United States, had started off on his remarkable tour that took him right down via various universities on the eastern seaboard to New Orleans and then up through the Middle West to places like Ann Arbor and Chicago, and eventually back to New York. Now, what he did was to produce a very interesting report to the Foreign Office on his journey and the lectures he gave, which I think they're reproduced in Volume 4 of the Collected Papers, which I edited some years ago, but I will come back to them again in the biography. But he did it was a very demanding task, and he did a very good job of work. And then he was asked to assist the Attorney General of the United States, who was then a Robert H. Jackson, subsequently a Supreme Court judge, and also later to become the principal United States prosecutor in the Nuremberg trials. He was asked by Jackson to assist him in the preparation of arguments justifying the United States Lend-Lease program and all aid to the Allies short of war. And this he did, and this is all documented, and Jackson in due course gave a major speech to the American Bar Association incorporating much of the draft that my father had produced for him. And this was obviously a source of satisfaction to the Foreign Office, who were obviously concerned about these matters. My father then returned to England in, I think it must have been January or February 1941. He became very restive and discontented with just sitting around doing nothing in the United States. So he came back to England, leaving my mother and myself in the United States. And I remained at Horace Mann until the December 1941, at which point I was then moved from New York up to Phillips Academy, Andover in Massachusetts. And this was a great move for me. Andover was a particularly good school and is now still one of the leaders of the American private school system, with considerable resources and buildings and all the things that a good school likes to have, gyms and swimming pools and so on. And there I had a very good, intense education in the years 42, 43, and the first half of 44, until I graduated from Andover in June 44. In the meantime, my mother had returned to England, which was quite a hazardous journey for her because the seas were by no means safe. But she got back to England safely and rejoined my father, and I was in the States on my own, where I enjoyed and had the benefit of the quasi-guardianship of a lady professor at Wellesley College, one of the principal women's colleges in the United States, called Louise Overacker. She was a professor of political science, and particularly to be remembered at the present moment, this being the 7th of January 2008, because her principal work was on American presidential primary elections. And she was very good to me. She used to invite me down to Boston to go to concerts of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, and then she looked after me during vacations and so on. I was greatly indebted to her, and I look back on my relationship with her with much affection. And so I stayed at Andover until June 1944, when I graduated, and was fortunate enough to be able to get a crossing back to England very soon afterwards. So I arrived back in Cambridge in, it must have been late June, early July 1944. Of course, the war was still on. The invasion of Europe had started only weeks previously. When I got back to England, my father was greatly disturbed by the awful American accent that I had acquired, which was not a genteel New England accent, but much of the worst of Brooklyn and Bronx combined in it. So I was just shut up in my room each day and told to listen to the wireless, which I did, and eventually was allowed to emerge and speak. So that being the summer of 44, it was arranged that I would go to Harrow for 2 years. That was the original intention. The assumption being that having been at school in America, I was insufficiently educated to cope with the situation in England. So to Harrow I went in September 1944 and was put into what they call the History Fifth. This is the second class from the top. And but fortunately, at just that time, there arrived the new head of history at Harrow, who was a friend of our neighbour in Cranmer Road, Cambridge, who was a professor here. And so this new history master at Harrow asked me to go and have a cup of tea with him, and we had a good chat. And he said, would you like to come up into the History Sixth, which I said I certainly would. And he took a great interest in me and helped me a lot, and so encouraged me, instead of aiming to spend 2 years at Harrow, to spend only one. And the idea was that I would take a Trinity Trial scholarship exam in March of 45, and I was fortunate enough to be successful. I got a so-called minor scholarship at Trinity, which is quite good enough for my purposes. And so I left Harrow at the end of the summer term of 1945 and came up to Trinity as an entrance scholar in October 1945. Now that was, as you realize, just after the end of the war in Europe. And so the process of demobilization had already begun. And Trinity had a large proportion of its undergraduate intake consisting of ex-servicemen, men who had fought, some of them several years in the war, were battle-scarred and were quite mature people. And they were extraordinarily kind to me because instead of being impatient or short with a 17-year-old, which is what I was then, they helped me and sought from me help because they had themselves lost contact with academic exercise. So we became good friends, many of us. And I began, therefore, in October 45 to read history at Trinity. And I read history for 2 years. I succeeded in getting a first in my first year, but in my second year I did not get a first. I got a 2-1, and this was regarded by my father as almost unforgivable lapse in standards. But I simply didn't take to some of the subjects I was meant to be learning. For example, one of my principal subjects was medieval history, and it meant nothing to me at all. I just wasn't interested. And even today I couldn't tell you what was the period of the Dark Ages or quite who Charlemagne was or things like that. So anyway, I read history for 2 years, and at the end of my second year, on the advice of my director of studies, who was a great fellow called Kitson Clark, I moved to law. He said I would be better off as a lawyer, and as it turns out, he was right. So in 1946, October, I began reading law. I read what is called the Law Qualifying 2 exam, and then I followed that in another year with the Law Tripos Part 2, which are the ordinary English law subjects, including international and constitutional law. And then after I had finished Law Tripos, my father urged me to stay on and read for the LLB, now called the LLM, specializing in international law, the so-called Section D of the LLB. And being a dutiful son, and one I think who had enough sense to follow good parental advice in that matter at any rate, I stayed on for the extra year. But I began to chafe a little bit in the course of that year. And I remember very well walking back with my father from a lecture one day, because it was his practice to lecture on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 12 to 1, and it was my habit to accompany him on his walk home from the then Squire Law Library to Cranmer Road to have lunch with my parents. And I said to him, you know, I was getting fed up, I recalled the lines of Bernard Shaw, who said that those who can do and those who can't teach. And my father, and I've never forgotten, said to me, yes, maybe, but it's a good life. And now that I've spent more than 50 years in Cambridge, I realize what a good life it is, and in my case could have been, if I'd stuck to teaching. But my interests range more widely than that, as I will tell you presently. But that took me through to 1950. 1949, 1950 was the year of my LLB. So then in June 1950, I made a mistake about the years. In June 1950, I finished the LLB here and was ready to step out into the wide world. In the meantime, I'd been taking the bar exams. I had become a member of Gray's Inn, and I was taking the bar exams with a view to doing my finals and being called to the bar. Well, I took my bar exams. In those days, nobody attached much importance to the result you got, and I passed with a third, except in one subject which I failed, which I think was equity. And so I had to retake that. In due course, I was called to the bar, and I became a pupil in chambers in London at 3 Essex Court, which was a leading set of commercial chambers. And my pupil master was John McGaw, who was a brilliant lawyer, had a first-class mind of Northern Ireland extraction, a rugger international, a very demanding, a very highly principled man, who eventually went on to the High Court bench and then to the Court of Appeal, and should really have been promoted to the House of Lords. But I think that his temper was a little bit short and irascible, and that did not make him popular. So he didn't get to the House of Lords, but I always remember him as a great teacher to me, and very exacting in his standards, and he required a good work, and I tried to satisfy him. So there I was in chambers in October 1950. But I have to go back a few months, because in the course of that summer of 1950, I had become a joint secretary of a government committee, a committee of established by the Cabinet Office and the Foreign Office for the purpose of looking into the law of state immunity, the so-called Somerville Committee, which consisted of Lord Justice Somerville and a number of high civil servants, plus some academics, which included Professor Hampson, who was the then Professor of Comparative Law in this university, and my father. And so I became joint secretary of that committee, and the other secretary was a civil servant, a very nice chap called Geoffrey Penn. And together we administered and did whatever was necessary, and I spent my summer in the Foreign Office doing research on diplomatic immunity. And by the time I finished, I produced a quite substantial memorandum in which I had analysed and presented a lot of the material in the Foreign Office archives on various questions of diplomatic immunity.
Interesting.
So then I went into chambers with John McGaw. I was living in a house in Albany Street with several ex-Cambridge people. We had a very agreeable bachelor existence there. And I used to walk down from the top end of Albany Street to the Temple most mornings, and get into chambers. And in those days, it was appropriate to wear striped trousers and black jacket and a bowler hat and carry a furled umbrella, all of which I dutifully did. So there I was in chambers as a pupil. We're at 1950. And so I spent my time in chambers working on commercial law, insurance, shipping law, banking, bankers' commercial credits, all those kinds of things. And in order to eke out my existence, because funds were not very ample, I did two kinds of lecturing. I lectured in one of the city colleges. I remember on exceptions in charter parties and bills of lading, a subject about which I knew absolutely nothing before my lectures and little enough after. And I was only about 5 minutes ahead of my class. So I did that. And also, more comfortably, I was lecturing in the evenings at the London School of Economics in international law. At that time, the law faculty at LSC was run by two very fine men. One was Sir David Hughes Parry, and the other was Professor Jim Gower. And they were very, very supportive and encouraging, and I enjoyed my teaching there in the evenings. And ultimately, this led them in early 1953 to offer me a post, a full-time teaching post at LSC, and indicated very strongly that if I took it, I would probably get a chair within 5 years, which would have been a splendid thing to have happened. At the same time, however, I received an offer from Trinity College, Cambridge, because I had, in addition to the teaching on bills of lading at the City College or whatever it was called, and the evening teaching at LSE, I was coming up to Cambridge at weekends to supervise in Trinity. So I would leave London on a Friday afternoon, reach Cambridge in time to do 2 or 3 hours of supervision before 8 o'clock hall on Friday. And then I would go into hall and maybe do another hour after, and on Saturday morning would do another 2 or 3. So it was really quite a demanding schedule. And then to that was added the possibility, or the opportunity, I should say, of giving some lectures in the faculty. Because at that time, the faculty had, as professor, my father, and there was Robbie Jennings and Clive Parry, but there wasn't anybody, so to speak, younger than them doing any work. And so I was given the opportunity of lecturing on the law of international organization and the law of war. And so I was doing that also. Well, as I say, at Trinity in, it must have been early 1953, offered me a fellowship and a college lectureship, which I have to distinguish from a university lectureship, a college lectureship, which involved my supervising in college, ultimately 12 hours a week. And I was sorely torn. I did not know which to take, London or Cambridge. But eventually I chose Cambridge. As I look back on it, I think that the factors that most influenced me were, one, that the Cambridge academic year was significantly shorter than the LSE year. And the LSE had 30 teaching weeks, and Cambridge only had not even 24. It had 24 weeks of the 3 terms, but effectively only 20 teaching weeks. So that was a most favourable aspect of Cambridge. And also the quality of life in Cambridge was more agreeable. I was given a nice set of rooms in college, so I chose Cambridge. Often I have looked back and asked myself, did I make the right decision? Because in terms of the impact that I might have made on international law, I think that if I had been in London and had got a chair at a relatively early age, I would have been able to influence developments in international activity and teaching in England more than I was able to. Nonetheless, as I say, it's no good going back over things like that. And so that brings us to 1953. And I came up to Trinity and had a very nice room, a set of rooms in New Court of Trinity, looking out on that big chestnut tree in the middle of the court. And of course, at about that time, I was courting the lady who eventually became my wife. And we got married in July 1955, 2 years after I came up to Trinity. And she was in London studying law at London School of Economics. Then, as I say, I spent the year of 50, the second half of 53 at Trinity. Now, even before I had left London, left Chambers, and I never actually left Chambers in the sense of ceasing to be a tenant there, because I had become one in the previous year. Even before I had moved to Cambridge, I was already getting work of an international law nature. Opinions and so on. And most of the work then came from a firm, well-known firm, solicitors Linklaters and Paynes, who were the solicitors of the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, later to become BP. And so I was doing opinions for them at the same time as I was teaching in Cambridge. Then we move into 1954. And I'm continuing the work in London, going up to London very often during the week and coming back within the day. And in 1954, there began the intensive preparations that led up to the resolution of the Iranian oil nationalization. Now, the Iranian oil nationalization. This had happened in 1950 when Mossadegh had been prime minister. In the winter of 1953, BP, or Anglo-Iranian as it then was, had asked me to analyze and assess the possible Iranian counterclaims, which had been identified by the BBC World Service from Iranian radio broadcasts. And I remember spending 3 very hard working weeks in December 1953 analyzing the situation and discovering that even at that time, BP, Iran could counterclaim against BP for a quite considerable sum, but nothing, of course, compared to what Iran owed BP arising out of the nationalization. So by the beginning of 1954, I was well in with Anglo-Iranian, and I was constantly being asked for advice. Their principal outside lawyer was Sir Hartley Shawcross, who had been Attorney General in the Labour government, but by then had returned to private practice. So he and I worked together quite closely. Eventually, in the course of 1954, it must have been July, August 1954, I was included in the team of lawyers that was sent out to Iran to help in the negotiation of the so-called consortium agreement, which was the agreement that brought the nationalization to an end. So I went out to Iran in the summer of 1954 as part of this team. We were 14 lawyers representing 8 oil companies. There were the 5 American majors, Standard of New Jersey, Standard of New York, Saucony, and Standard of California, SoCal, plus Gulf and one other American major, Texas, the Texas oil company. There were 5 American companies. Each of them had a lawyer there. And then there were the 3 European companies, Anglo-Iranian, CFP, Compagnie Française de Pétrole, and Shell, who were also involved. But of course, Anglo-Iranian was, in a sense, the one that was most interested. But having regard to the circumstances which had given rise to the opening of negotiations, namely American influence in Iran, the lead lawyer in our team was a man called Tom Monahan, who was the general counsel of ESSO, Standard of New York. He was a very able and very nice man who most sadly died not very long afterwards. But it was he who prepared the basic outline of the consortium agreement. And so we were 14 lawyers round the table, and we worked in the garden of a lovely house in Tajrish in Tehran, and we drafted the consortium agreement. Each of us was responsible for certain articles, and I was given the articles that related to proper law, a non-interference by the host state, and dispute settlement, which were very interesting articles. And I'm very glad to observe that over time, those articles, particularly the one on dispute settlement, have been adopted very widely in the oil industry in its relations with host countries. So the summer of 1954 was taken up largely with the Iranian settlement. There I met a number of what we call principals, that is to say, not lawyers, but the directors and executives of the company, and they were all very charming. The whole exercise was great fun, and for me, I was then 26 years old, a great eye-opener, and I learned a lot. So,
you mentioned in your list that you kindly gave me that you encountered during this period Stephen Schwebel.
Oh, I missed him. Let me, I'll come back to them in a moment. But I just wanted to conclude on what was happening in the summer of 1954. And that is that I met these oil company executives. And I then formed the idea that it would be very nice if we could establish an institution that could collect some money and distribute it in the development and research of international law. And so I was able to set up the International Law Fund with contributions from Shell and Anglo-Iranian and a few other companies. And it was very generous of them to help us out then. Unfortunately, they couldn't keep up their contributions, and I didn't have the standing or indeed the energy or time to go on pressing them and others for further funds. So the International Law Fund, although it still exists and still has a certain amount of money, which we, the trustees, the present trustees, would much like to see used for good causes, it hasn't actually grown very significantly. The initial trustees were Sir Hartley Shawcross, Lord McNair, and Sir Gerald Fitzmaurice, who was then the legal advisor of the Foreign Office. So that was one of the side growths of the summer of 1953. Now, I passed perhaps too rapidly over the academic side of things. As I told you earlier, I had been supervising in college, which was quite demanding. I supervised only in, well, I remember in those first years I had to supervise in something called English Legal System, which I found incredibly boring. It was mainly ancient legal history and didn't really suit me at all. But then I was left with constitutional law and international law, two subjects which went very well together, and I enjoyed that. And of course, in those days, constitutional law was very different from what it is now. Then the remedies against the Crown were identified as being prohibition, mandamus, certiorari, habeas corpus. Today you have administrative law, a whole new area of law judicially developed, which is most exciting. But then we had to work our way through the so-called prerogative writs. Then I had some associations outside my strict academic teaching. In 1950, I had arrived in Cambridge Stephen Schwebel, who was a graduate of Harvard University, who had not yet been to law school, but had an interest in international law, and had indeed already written a book on the Secretary General of the United Nations, which was quite a remarkable achievement for a man who was then only about 23 years old. So I began my friendship with him then, which has, I am glad to say, subsisted to the present day, and we've been very close friends ever since. And he has, of course, progressed mightily, having eventually become President of the International Court of Justice. Now, another person with whom I had some close connection at that time was an Indian gentleman called Nagendra Singh. He was the son of a Maharaja of a small princely state called Dungapur. But unusually for younger sons, he had gone into the Indian civil service. He'd been at Cambridge before the war, and he decided he wanted to learn international law. He'd come back to England for a year to the Imperial Defence College, and had got in touch with my father to ask whether he could recommend somebody who could help him find his way around international law as he taught himself the subject. So my father recommended me because I was in London, and so Nagendra Singh and I began a very, very pleasant relationship. We met once a week for dinner, and he would give me dinner, and I would talk international law with him. And from that, there sprouted a friendship that lasted until Nagendra Singh's untimely and premature death, when he was actually president of the International Court of Justice. So those were two associations that went back to the earliest days of my involvement in international law.
I wondered about that.
So now we can come back to 1954. And one thing that happened in 1954, which was very interesting, was the Rosemary case. When Anglo-Iranian was nationalized in 1950, it began a series of measures aimed at inhibiting the sale of oil from the area of what had been the Anglo-Iranian concession. They just obviously didn't want to let the Iranians get away with it. So they issued warning notices in the press of the world saying that if anybody buys oil from Iran, we will sue them because we consider that it's our oil since it has been unlawfully taken from us by an act of nationalization without compensation. And I was involved when I was in chambers with John McGaw in quite a lot of that activity. And then lo and behold, sometime in 1953, I think it must have been, there was a little tanker called the Rosemary, which left Iran with a cargo of oil and broke down not very far from Aden, where it was taken into Aden with the aid of a tug. And because Aden was at that time a British colony, proceedings were begun immediately by Anglo-Iranian against the vessel and its owners for the recovery of the oil. And John McGaw was flown out to Aden and conducted proceedings before the judge there. The short argument being, this cargo of oil belongs to Anglo-Iranian because it has come from an area within the Anglo-Iranian concession, and Anglo-Iranian owned that oil there, and there has been no valid transfer of title. Excuse me. No valid transfer of title because of the violation of international law. Now, this set of instructions from London solicitors came into chambers, and John McGaw said, I don't know anything about this sort of matter. And I said, well, I think I can help you here. So I took the papers away that weekend and worked on it and produced a note for him by the following Monday. And then he went off to Aden, and there he succeeded in getting a decision in favour of Anglo-Iranian. And then there was an appeal lodged. In those days, appeals lay from the courts of Aden to the East African Court of Appeal in Nairobi. And that appeal came on for hearing in Nairobi in December 1954. And I was part of the small team that went out to participate in it. The leader was Sir Hartley Shawcross. John McGaw was with him, and I was the second junior. And then we were accompanied by the instructing solicitor, John Gauntlet, from Linklaters and Payne's, and the company secretary of Anglo-Iranian, Bill Park, not Bill Park, oh dear, they've suddenly slipped my mind. But anyway, all very agreeable people. And we turned up in Nairobi for the hearing, and the appellants, the owners and charterers of the vessel, didn't turn up at all. So the case was immediately dismissed for want of prosecution, and we all had a great party in the New Stanley Hotel that night, and we came home. And one of our party, let him be nameless, but it wasn't me, was taken off the plane in London, suffering, as he claimed, from nervous exhaustion, and brought on, no doubt, by overconsumption of alcohol. But we were a very happy party. And the Rosemary became a very famous case was the subject of much academic and professional comment, and it played a role in the development of a large case law in the United States and to some extent in the United Kingdom on the effect in domestic law of foreign actions violative of international law. So that was the Rosemary in 1954.
Very,
and we move on then to the next significant matter in which I was involved. When I came back from Tehran in 1954, having concluded the consortium agreement, And there were many meetings between the oil companies in London to work out exactly how their relationship was to be maintained. And I would go to those meetings together with the silk who was leading me, a very, very fine man called Milner Holland, and to represent Anglo-Iranian, or which had by then changed its name to British Petroleum, BP. And there at those meetings, on behalf of Shell, there was a very fine lawyer called Sir Valentine Holmes, exceedingly able advocate, not a person of exactly charismatic character, but a man who made a great impression on the courts by his ability as a lawyer and his modesty in the way in which he presented things. Val Holmes was there for Shell, and he seemed to like the way I was doing things. So Shell asked BP whether BP would have any objection to my assisting Shell in another matter. And so I was briefed to go out to Singapore in a case in which Shell was seeking to recover from the Crown quantities of oil and petroleum stocks that had been found by the Crown upon the liberation of Singapore, these being stocks that had been taken from the concession areas in the Dutch East Indies belonging to Shell and its Dutch associate Batavse Petroleum Maatschappij, BPM. So I went out to Singapore to assist the local lawyer, who was an Englishman, the senior partner in the major firm in Singapore called Drew and Napier. And we fought the case at first instance, but unfortunately we lost it. And the decision was taken that we should appeal, and the advice I had to give was that I thought that it would be necessary for Sir Hartley Shawcross to go out and do the appeal. And this he did. We had a very enjoyable time out there together, and he succeeded. And interestingly enough, the Crown did not prosecute an appeal from the Court of Appeal in Singapore to the Privy Council, as it was entitled to do. In other words, the Crown was indicating that it might not win in the Privy Council. It didn't want to fail on that issue, which was the issue of whether the Japanese had acquired a title to the oil stocks, such as to classify it as booty of war, which the captor, i.e. the UK, could seize and hold. And we established that it was not booty of war. So that was the Singapore oil stocks in 1954. And then at the same time, I have to recall, I was pursuing an academic career. And so at about that time, I developed the idea that it would be useful to have a survey of contemporary British practice in the field of international law. And so I began the series, which was initially called BPIL, British Practice in International Law. Oh no, it was actually called The Contemporary Practice of the United Kingdom in the Field of International Law, which is a rather heavy title, which was subsequently abbreviated to BPIL, British Practice in International Law. And I started that, the first issue, I think, came out in the as a supplement to or as an article in the International and Comparative Law Quarterly.
Has it been continued, Sir Eli?
Sorry?
Has this been continued?
No, I'm going to go on and tell you about that.
Sorry.
And so I began BPIL, which was really involved me in surveying all official UK activity in the field of international law, namely proceedings in Parliament, judicial decisions, treaties, and so on, and presenting them in classified form. And I did this for some years, and eventually in the later years, as I got busier and busier, I had the assistance of Gillian White, who had recently got a PhD at London for her book on nationalisation in international law, and Gillian was an immense help, and between us we continued it. And then we began to fall behind, or I began to fall behind, so much so that, to my surprise, the British Institute took it upon itself to take the matter out of my hands. And although they had the copy for the 1968 issue, they never published it. And eventually the whole idea was transferred into the British Yearbook of International Law, where it currently appears as what we call UKMI, the United Kingdom Materials on International Law. But that very useful annual compilation in the British Yearbook has its roots in British practice in international law, in the International and Comparative Law Quarterly. Now, one thing I haven't mentioned is that, of course, in about 1959, I'm afraid I'm getting a little bit out of order chronologically, but still, in about 1959, steps were being taken to establish the British Institute of International and Comparative Law. The prime movers were Lord Denning and Lord Diplock, and I think Lord Wilberforce. And they were generous enough to ask me if I might be interested in being director. And we had a meeting at which I represented that I thought that if the British Institute was to carry academic weight, it really needed to be associated with a university, and the director should be a professor in a university, and that way it would have some standing, academic or standing. Now, this did not commend itself to them, and they eventually chose a very fine man, Norman Marsh, to be the first director of the Institute. His inclinations were more attuned to their ideas of the Institute being a place where all sorts of people could meet, and that it was aimed less at academic production in those days than at conveying to the profession developments in the law and giving professionals an opportunity to discuss it. And so the British Institute came into existence, and with it, the International and Comparative Law Quarterly, and the publication within which I initially produced BPIL. Now, I've also got myself quite seriously out of order chronologically, because by emphasizing the Anglo-Iranian oil negotiations with Iran, which began, as I say, in 53 and went on in 54, I've omitted to mention the Notterbohm case in the International Court of Justice. This was a case between Liechtenstein and Guatemala arising out of the seizure of the assets of Mr. Notterbohm, a Liechtenstein national. The solicitor who was running the case was a very capable man called Lowenfeld. Lowenfeld was a solicitor in Cambridge who had come from Germany before the war. And he was close to the Liechtenstein government, and so was able to develop the case for them. Initially, they had used my father for advice and guidance, but my father was elected to the International Court of Justice in November of 1954, and therefore he could not continue with the case. They needed, in any event, a junior to do the drafting, and so I was instructed to prepare the memorial, which is the first pleading in the case, in the Notterbohm case. And there was an objection to the jurisdiction of the court raised by Guatemala, and the counsel for Liechtenstein was Guggenheim, Swiss professor from Geneva, very able man, and I wasn't actually formally instructed to participate in that hearing, though I was there, and we won on jurisdiction. Then we went on to the merits, And the difficulty there was that this coincided with the very heavy work that I was doing, A, in teaching in Cambridge, and B, in working on the Anglo-Iranian matters. So I wasn't able to meet the deadlines, and so Lowenfeld transferred the work to Dr. Lipstein, and that's how he came into the matter. So that was not a bone. Back in 1953 or 54. So we go on from there to... Can we just have a pause for a bit, do we?
Of course.
It's really quite hard work.
Absolutely. What I'll do is... I'll just edit out... I'll leave it on, Sir Ellie, because when I stop, it then makes two files. There isn't an actual facility to pause. It's either record or stop. So that means that over the weekend, it's difficult for me to listen to the files as one, and I'd like to. So I'm simply going to edit this interlude.
So it's got enough capacity to cope with these interruptions.
Yes, it has. I'll just have a look and see. Yes, I put in some new batteries before I came.
I see.
So it's okay.
Very good.
Yes.
All right. Well, we'll go on then.
But it's really absolutely brilliant. As we're going along, you must just say when you want to stop,
and we'll
then carry on again.
Yeah, sure thing.
Yes, lovely.
So to start again, on the academic side, at about that time, I had been made an assistant lecturer in Cambridge, and so I had a post in the university. And there I was lecturing on the law of international institutions and the law of war and dispute settlement. I gave two lectures in each course every week during the academic year, which was quite demanding because I had to prepare them from scratch. And my normal practice at that time was to get up at 5 o'clock every morning and work without interruption until 9 o'clock, preparing the lecture. Then I was able to give it at 10 o'clock before I'd forgotten everything I'd learned in the previous 4 hours. And I was also asked in that year, 1959, to become director of studies of the research center of the Hague Academy of International Law. As you know, the Hague Academy runs courses of lectures each year. But in addition, it began at that time to have a supplementary activity in the form of a research center where there was a director of studies and a group of qualified, mostly postgraduate, or indeed all postgraduate students working together on a subject nominated by the Academy. And it was in two divisions, an English-speaking and a French-speaking division. So I was asked to direct the English-speaking division in the year 1959 when we dealt with the law of treaties. And then that was continued in the year 1960 for the law of the sea. And that was a time when I began my friendship with a number of people whom I maintain contact ever since, particularly Krzysztof Skubiszewski, who subsequently became foreign minister of Poland and has for the last number of years been the president of the Iran-US Claims Tribunal. So I did that in those 2 years, and that was the very most satisfying teaching I was doing, because one of the interesting aspects of it was that people who had never really been involved or immersed in the jurisprudence of the international court for the first time became closely acquainted with it, and it achieved quite a conversion in their thinking. And this was particularly true of the people who came from the communist countries. And there were several Poles for whom it was an eye-opener, and very satisfying for me to see how their attitudes developed. And not only did I have Skubiszewski there, I had my old friend Hans Blix and others too. So
you mentioned, Sir Ellie, the name of Collier.
Yes, and John Collier was also one of the participants in I think, the 1960 session. Then we move on to the problem of flags of convenience. I'm not sure about the dates exactly, but while I was working on British practice in international law, of course I was familiar with the emergence of the new international organization, IMCO, the International Maritime Consultative Organization. And one day I got a telephone call from solicitors in London, Coward Chance as they then were, asking whether I could assist them. And it appeared that Mr. Niarchos, who was a major owner of ships under the Greek flag and other flags of convenience, was very much concerned about the way in which the IMCO assembly was approaching the problem of the composition of the Maritime Safety Committee. The inclination of a number of the traditional ship-owning states, for example, the United Kingdom, Norway, France, and so on, was to exclude Liberia and Panama from membership of the Maritime Safety Committee because they, in the view of the traditional states, those other states did not own the shipping that flew their flag. And the composition of the Maritime Safety Committee was prescribed by the Constitution of IMCO as being composed of the largest ship-owning nations. So this was a move to exclude these states. And Mr. Niarchos and others wanted to oppose that. And I went down to assist them and went to the IMCO conference. And we eventually prevailed with the assistance of the United States, which favored the existence of these flags of convenience. We prevailed upon the IMCO assembly to seek an advisory opinion from the International Court on the composition of the Maritime Safety Committee. And in that, I played a substantial role in drafting the pleadings of the Liberian government. I didn't actually appear on their behalf because the people who represented them in the case, in the hearings, were two Liberian officials. But I had written all the memoranda and indeed drafted the speeches for them beforehand. And we succeeded in the International Court in establishing or maintaining the right of Liberia and Panama to be members of the Maritime Safety Committee. It was an occasion on which I had an unexpected opportunity to deploy some of the knowledge I'd acquired in teaching constitutional law in Cambridge, because one of the members of the court asked a question, namely, whether when Great Britain had voted against Liberia and Panama, it had been aware of the true size of the true details of the ownership of Liberian and Panamanian flag ships. And Council for Britain got up and answered, no, they didn't know the exact numbers. My Liberian colleagues were all for jumping up and commenting straight away. I said, no, just wait, and we'll deal with it later. And we came back to it later, and we were able to point out that in a British constitutional case called AP Picture Houses and Wednesbury Corporation, an administrative action was deemed to be invalid if taken on the basis of unsound knowledge of the facts. And so we were able to get up and point out that here was the British government saying that it didn't really know the facts before it exercised its vote. And the court seemed to absorb that point and say eventually gave a decision in favour of Liberia and Panama. And the Maritime Safety Committee was reconstituted at the next conference of IMCO. So that takes us to sort of the end of 1959, the beginning of 1960. And the next major event in my life, and it was really a major and traumatic event, was the death of my father, Sir Hersch Leiterpacht, in May 1960. This had not been expected. He had a heart attack in October 1959 and in The Hague, and he'd gone off for 6 months to recuperate. Then he returned to The Hague in, I think it was April 1960, and then had shown some unsatisfactory signs, and the doctors in The Hague recommended that he should go back to England to consult doctors here, and he saw Lord Moron, who was one of the principal physicians in London at that time, who immediately said that he should see a specialist, and the specialist said, I must operate on you without any further delay. And this was in the first week of May 1960, and he went into the London clinic for an operation that took place on the 8th of May, and he didn't come out of the operation. He had a further heart attack during the operation. That's a strange thing, that there was no cardiologist or cardiac surgeon available at that time. It was a Sunday. But not that it would necessarily have saved him, nor indeed that it would necessarily have been to his advantage, because in the course of the operation they had identified the fact that he had a cancer of the bowel, which had spread into the liver and was inoperable. So he would have had a very unhappy remaining few months of life. So he was taken very suddenly and very unexpectedly from my mother and myself on Sunday, 8 May 1960. And his passing, obviously, was emotionally devastating, but it also impacted on my life, because there were all sorts of things that had to be done following his death. And one of them was that arrangements needed to be made regarding the editing of the international law reports, which was the series that he had begun with Arnold McNair way back in 1929. And so I took on the editing of that with the approval of Lord McNair, who was the then chairman of the committee of advisors, and was immensely helped. In fact, I couldn't have done it without her, by Gillian White, who had been helping me on the BPIL, and she worked for some years until she got her own share at Manchester, and her involvement in the ILR dropped off, and I managed to keep the thing going, and then when I came back from Australia, a matter which I'll come in due course, I was able to recruit a young Cambridge graduate called Christopher Greenwood to assist me. And that was back in 1978. And here we are 30 years later, and Christopher Greenwood is professor at the London School of Economics and the British-nominated candidate for election to the International Court in this coming November. And we hope, of course, that that election will be successful. And he has, for 30 years, really maintained the ILR, and I hope he'll go on doing so for a long time yet. And it's become a very significant series. It now runs through 132 volumes, having been left by my father back at volume, I think the volume for 1957, which was rather by somewhere in the 20s. So it's gone on. It has problems, financial problems, because it's expensive to produce, and it has only a limited circulation, and the material that needs to be covered by a series of international law reports has expanded incredibly. There are so many new international tribunals and so much more international law litigation in national courts that even now that it's expanded to 4 volumes a year, it still finds it very difficult to cope with the material. So we're in the process now of trying to resolve those difficulties. One way in which we're approaching it is to put it all online, and that will be done by the Cambridge University Press in due course. But, as I say, after my father's death, I took on the ILR. I had foolishly, while he was still alive, and he had made the suggestion to me that I should take over the editing of Oppenheim's International Law, I'd foolishly been childishly arrogant. I said, no, I'm going to write my own book. I never have. and I didn't take on the editing of Oppenheim, which may actually have been to the ultimate benefit of the international community, because it was edited in due course, though after a lapse of some 20-30 years, by Sir Robert Jennings and Sir Arthur Watts. And their edition, their ninth edition of the first volume of Oppenheim, is a major contribution to the subject, and they've done it very much better than I ever could have. But I've regretted over the years that I didn't approach it more constructively. So, in order to provide a suitable memorial for my father, I decided that I would try and republish in systematic form the many articles that he'd written on international law. He had intended to write his own textbook, but never got round to it. But he left some outlines, and so I followed those outlines, and it took a long time to do the job, but eventually we produced the five volumes of the collected papers, their publication dates ranging from the late 60s till the early 2000s. And in that task, the completion of that task, I was greatly aided by one of my assistants, Penelope Neville, who is now a fellow of Downing College. So we then go on to other events in 1960s. One early event in the 1960s was the so-called Lost Counties dispute in Uganda. Uganda had become a British protectorate in the early part of the 20th century. It had been Britain's practice when occupying territories in Africa to use one tribe to help subdue the next. And so when it came to Uganda, it had used the Baganda to help subdue the Banyoro, and had rewarded the Baganda with land belonging to the Banyoro, the so-called six lost counties. And as the date for the termination of British rule in Uganda approached in 1962, the Banyoro became very restive. They were prepared to live with this deprivation of territory so long as Britain was in control. But the thought that Britain was going meant that they didn't feel comfortable with it. So they sought help in the UK. And the Omukama of Banyoro, who was a very nice man, didn't quite know what to do. There was a British journalist working there, and he asked him to find some help. And the journalist came to a solicitor friend of his in Leeds. And one day I got this telephone call from a solicitor in Leeds saying, "You don't know me. I'm not sure whether you can help me, but this is my problem." And he then expounded the problem. He said, "What can we do?" And I gave him certain advice, and he came down. He was a very nice chap again, called Jerry Perlman, and we worked out a course of action, which included the recruitment of John Foster, Sir John Foster QC, to lead me, because John Foster was a parliamentarian with excellent connections, and he would know better than I did what to do. And so in the meantime, the government here had appointed a committee or commission of privy councillors to go out to Uganda to look into the situation. So he and I went out to appear before the commission at its hearings in Hoima in Uganda. There we were confronted by the lawyers for the Baganda, they were, oh dear, the name's suddenly gone from my mind. But anyway, a very able English silk. But we did in the end get a recommendation from the commission that two of the counties should be returned to the Banyoro, and that was done. It wasn't exactly a case of public international law, though there were certain international law elements in it. It was a case that involved consideration of the history of Uganda and of the sociology of the people there, but very interesting nonetheless. So that was the Uganda episode. Now, that brought me into closer contact with John Foster. John Foster was at that time engaged as one of the council in what was one of the, what was and still is in a way, one of the most important cases dealt with by the International Court, the Barcelona traction case. But John was contemplating a retirement from the bar at that time. So he recommended to the people concerned that I should be taken in to assist them. The people concerned were the Société Générale, a major Belgian company, who were representing, who were themselves shareholders in the Barcelona Traction Company. The Barcelona Traction Company had, as its name suggests, had major interest in the electricity industry in Barcelona and thereabouts. And they had lost their assets to the machinations of quite a distinguished Spanish entrepreneur called Juan Marc. And so Spain had taken up their case in the International Court. So in that way began my association with Barcelona Traction, which endured until the case was finished in 1970, unfortunately without success, but it was it's a source of material for international lawyers, but I was quite busy with that. And also at about that time, the British South Africa Company ran into problems in northern Rhodesia. As northern Rhodesia approached independence, the question was what was to happen to their royalty rights, and various steps had to be taken to protect them. I think I'll stop there.
Thank you so much, sir.
Not at all. We'll just draw a line across that point, shall
Excellent.
We?
Thank you.